My name is Brian Bonsenauer. The title of this session is Thinking Water, Why We Have More in Common with Whirlpools Than with Machines. And my background is in kind of systems theory. And so that's kind of the focus that I want to talk about today, but also with this element of water that seems to be very much a part of our theme this summer in the village, the water washed, spirit born, the importance that water has played in the whole spiritual journey out of our tradition for the Hebrew people and their kind of nomadic, arid life. Water was certainly a key to surviving in that, and has become for us a very central religious theme. Water. So we'll talk some about water from that perspective as well. The kind of flow of the sessions that I've been doing here has been on the origin of the universe and what meaning that has for our lives, what some of the scientific perspectives from the past several decades have or may have for us. The focus that I've taken with that, and that I think is a focus that's coming out just recently of some of this scientific method, has been to re-image the scientific method, the scientific journey as a story, to look at what this scientific enterprise has uncovered about the way that the world is, the way that the universe is, in terms of story. And the real exciting part of this for me is that thinking about science as story opens up and makes manifest the mystery that has always been and always will be inherent in the scientific enterprise. That the scientific enterprise is deeply rooted in a sense of mystery, a sense of awe and wonder at the world, as expressed by some of the most eminent scientists in the world. But with also woven into our scientific understanding are deep mysteries. And so it seems that the paradigm or the process of telling stories is in fact a better avenue to being aware of that mystery that underlies what we do know. There are certainly things that we can say with a good degree of accuracy that we know about the way the world works through repeated and verified observation, but to tell them in a way that that leaves open the spaces between those things, of which there are many, and to leave that open for us to be struck by the awe, the wonder, and to try to say, what meaning does this have for my life, for the way that I live, the way that I see my relationship with other people, with the earth, with the rest of creation. This is one work that I found real useful in that process. It's called The Universe Story by Brian Swim and Thomas Berry. They have it over here in the bookstore, so if it's something that seems interesting to you, I highly recommend it. I've really enjoyed it. So much so that I'll be teaching a class next semester using this book as a part of that course. And it's one of their focuses in this book as well, that story, using story to re-image or to retell the scientific enterprise has great power and is very needed for us. So the focus tonight, then, is around water. So I have some things here around water. But to get us into that, I want to get us started in that with some story. So if you'll just sit back and relax a little bit, we'll tell some of the story out of the Universe Story, Brian Swim and Thomas Berry here. So that's a part of the story, the Universe Story, as we understand it now to have come into being. And the emphasis in that part that I'd like to sort of guide our talk tonight as well is the idea of these galaxies sweeping up this hydrogen and helium into organized systems. The system perspective is one that that I'm very partial to in thinking about the way the universe works, the way things work, and it's become off and on a way that has been very useful in this scientific enterprise. So I want to talk about some particular types of systems tonight, these self-organizing systems, also called dissipative systems. And we'll talk about sort of why, what that name means. And then link that to this topic of water and link that all into to how it, hopefully how it relates to us here. To get started, though, I want to get you involved with this as self-organizing systems. I want to get you all involved in more of a than just a listening way, right from the start here, with a prayer, in fact. This is a prayer out of the Aramaic tradition, which was, as you may know, the language that Jesus spoke. And there's been some fascinating work being done now to kind of recapture some of that tradition, to retranslate or to uncover translations from the living Aramaic tradition, which there's still a small part of, and to rephrase the New Testament and some of the well-known sayings of Jesus in the Aramaic, and to sort of search that language for the meanings of those prayers. And the prayer that I'd like to do is a simple chant, and it's based on the one of the names of God that we think that Jesus used. This comes out of work by Neil Douglas Klotz, who's done a lot of work with the Aramaic tradition and has visited and spent a lot of time with that living Aramaic tradition in the Middle East, and has retranslated some of these prayers, the Beatitudes and the Our Father in particular, into Aramaic in a book called Prayers of the Cosmos. And in that book, which is a wonderful little book, he not only gives the prayers in Aramaic, but discusses sort of the entomology of those words from the Aramaic, sort of the tradition behind the sounds and the vibrations that make up those words. In the Aramaic, the vibrations that form the words have meaning of them on their own. and putting those vibrations together, a single word has can tell a story in that. And the word that I'd like to chant with you tonight is Avun. Avun. It's a word that Jesus used for God, a root of, or another way of saying that word is Abba. The Abba and Avun are very linked in that. The Avun is the more formal of the two. It would be more like father, where Abba is more like papa or daddy. From Avun, another root meaning of the word is the creator. The creator, Avun. And depending on whether the B or the W is pronounced more, depends on what meaning it has. So the spelling of the word is this, at least an English rendition of that. Avun. Now, in talking about the roots or the vibrations that make up this word, he points out four in this. There's the ah at the beginning, and oftentimes in the chanting, it's almost not pronounced. It's the intake of breath, so it would be. And the V, again, you can emphasize the B or the W as kind of a V sound, depending on which connotation you want to give it. We won't worry too much about that. The U and the N. Let's see if I can mark those out. Four pieces. Now, one of the chants that he talks about in this book is a creation chant, as the word meaning creator. Also, the resonances have this sense of creation sort of buried within them. Again, the ah, that sort of non-vocalized intake of breath, is seen from this chant as this preparation before creation. So the intake of breath before the word of God is spoken. So this is like a preparation. This sort of harsh, almost explosive sound, this vuh sound, is this act of creation, that moment when creation begins. So this is kind of the moment. The ooh is used in many places in the Aramaic as this as the breath, the wind, the spirit of God, this breathing out. So avun is the spirit of God hovering upon the waters of creation. That image that's flowing out. And the end, interestingly, is this resonant quality, avun. In the chant, it's really resonated, and part of the prayer of the chant is to find your resonance when you chant this prayer, to find where your particular cavity, your nasal cavity, your chest cavity resonates. What's that resonant frequency for you? And so in the chanting, to kind of vary the pitch with which you chant it slightly until you feel that resonance sort of happening within your chest, within your head. So as we chant this, I'll encourage you to do that, to sort of vary that pitch a little bit, you know, a little bit higher, a little bit lower, and see where you you find a resonance. And this is the actual creation itself in the Aramaic tradition. This the idea of Shem, the vibration, the name. It's actually the thing itself, or the fundamental essence of the thing is in its vibration, in the vibration of that sound. So this is almost this resonant form of the creation. That's kind of the best thing that I can put on it right now. Translation. You could probably do a better job than that, but. So again, Avun. Avun. And we'll just chant this for a few minutes here and just take your own pace with it, your own sense of it. There's no pronunciation scoring here. Keep these in mind, and again, think of this as when you're chanting this, think of the story that this is telling. This is really, in this word creator, is really the creation story from the sense of this prayer. So keep that in mind in this chanting. Okay, so I'll just get us started and then just join in here when you feel called to. So there's an experience of this story that has been around for a long time, a way of re-imaging the story that gives it meaning. And that connection then of the chanting, the sounds of the chant, and the people chanting that make up that system of that story, that sort of that context in which that story happens. I'd like to focus on that kind of that last part to kind of move us into the next part of this talk, that resonating N sound. The resonance has played an interesting role in science and has come up again and again in the scientific enterprise, the idea of resonance. It's an experience, an observation that there are frequencies at which certain systems like to be at. They like to move in those ways. In systems theory, resonance is the focus of it, both the good aspects and the bad aspects of resonance are a focus in, especially in control system theory. And the resonance of that N sound from this prayer, this chant, within the chant, the idea is that you have your own resonant. You have this own frequency that is yours, that is individual to you, that is unique, that is the signature of God in you, in the makeup of your being. Your Shem, from that Aramaic word, is all of that about you. That's your unique presence in the world. With the resonances, they're way of talking about those has come out in the last the term dissipative system, I think, was coined by Ilya Krivonini. Is that how you say the name? Krivonini. And
excuse me, just a little hurting.
Okay. And this idea came out of some work with resonant systems, with thinking about those resonances. And just to kind of briefly introduce what the meaning or something of the meaning behind this term, dissipative system. In sort of the basic sense of it, science like to draw these sort of irregular shapes and call this a system. And in a dissipative system, the characteristic of it, or why we would call something a dissipative system, is because it takes in energy and kind of a high, I'm going to call this high energy. And this can either refer to quantity, oftentimes it refers to the type of energy going into. So these might be high frequency photons or electricity, which tends to be a higher grade of energy than, say, heat. So high energy, this idea of energy has a lot of potential behind it. Maybe that's the way of speaking of it. And the dissipative system gives off
a lower grade or a lower form of energy.
Now that's not so interesting in and of itself, because I mean, if you think of your coffee cup in the morning, it starts out hot and it gets warm over time, okay? So it's doing the same thing all the time. Starting with the high energy, there it's not so much taking in energy, but it's starting with a certain amount of energy and it's giving off this lower form of energy. That, among other names, has been termed second law of thermodynamics or entropy. The whole reason for coming up with a new name for things called dissipative systems was because these were systems that not only did this, took in high energy and gave off lower energy, but in that process created order. Higher degree of order in that system than in the surrounding systems. So these dissipative systems made use of this energy, this high energy, to create order, and in the process gave off this low energy. Some examples of that are certainly you and I, all right? We are dissipative systems. We take in a higher form of energy. If you had dinner tonight, you know that that higher form of energy included garlic. So there was, which is, I think, the highest form of energy, but... be that as it may, and then we give off a lower form of energy, both in our gas exchange and in our materials exchange, and we create order out of that. Our bodies do this without our, even without our thought process. You know, I cut myself earlier today, and that will heal, all right? But it's not just living systems. Certainly all living systems do this. Some of the initial work done with this was actually in just chemical systems. Chemical systems that, flushing those systems with high concentration and siphoning off lower concentration of these chemical systems, under certain conditions created this seemingly spontaneous order sort of flowing out of these systems. The Earth-Sun system is a dissipative system. The Earth takes in, if I just, instead of this blob, if I drew a sphere, and the Sun, over here, I'll draw a little smaller one since it's further away, smaller. The Sun is always pouring that onto the Earth, these high-energy photons, okay? And the Earth absorbs those high-energy photons. Some of them are absorbed by us walking around, some by the plants, some by just rocks and oceans. And in that process of absorbing it, the Earth radiates heat, or these low-energy photons. Okay. And so as you can see, this dissipative system right in action there, with the Sun forming this energy bank and the Earth, in effect, just getting in the way of those photons, and in being located in that place is in this position to form order out of that. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this in studying these systems is, why does this happen? What's the mechanisms that go on here? And the work is still going on with questions about that. I mean, certainly this might just happen, and in some systems this just happens where high energy high energy comes in, low energy goes out, and nothing interesting happens in between. So dissipative systems are interesting because of the order that is created out of them. I guess just to touch on my title, whirlpools are also dissipative systems. I'm going to use the high energy from the water, the potential energy of this water here, and create this ordered system by taking off the energy of that water and creating a lower energy water. The potential of the water down here is lower than the potential of the water up here. So just by kind of messing it up a little bit, it spontaneously creates this ordered system. And it's a pretty stable thing. I mean, it wants to be in this ordered state. It wants to have this form. This whirlpool form.
Is order always at rest?
Say it again, Deanne.
Well, at the bottom, it's not moving.
Right.
And is that, I would say it's at rest. Is that partly what this dissipative system is about, that it moves toward order that is not moving?
I would.
Not dynamic?
Actually, almost just the opposite would be my sense of it, that the order is really in the motion of the system there. That it's the system in motion that is showing that order. In fact, one of the definitions for. Pass this around so you can play with it. For systems. When this stops, all right? When these, either the photons coming in here and the photons going out are the same, the energy coming in and the energy going out is of the same level, is when there's no motion there, there's nothing happening there, that's called equilibrium. And I forget who coined this term, that's equilibrium equals death. I mean, that's the idea that with equilibrium, there's nothing interesting happens in that equilibrium. There's none of this order being created. So the stopping of the water in the bottom is, you could really think about this water in the bottom as the low energy system. Here's the high energy potential. And in the process of going from the low to the high energy potential, you get this order. Now there's nothing sort of sneaky going on here. Let's just move your hand here a minute. This little green thing doesn't have any vanes or, you know, any sort of propellers in there. There's no battery operated thing. That's just a little reducing, just a little smaller hole between the two. And the order that's coming out of there is just a spontaneous happening. It's just the way that the world works.
This is an area in which I'm fascinated. Mm. I know nothing about. So my question is probably not going to be really correct. I understand some terms and maybe they're not applicable, but my understanding would be there's one attractor in there that's causing this chaos to turn into some kind of ordered form. If you were to introduce other attractors, or if you were to introduce several of those going on at the same time, wouldn't you end up with ordered chaos?
Well, that so a couple of terms there: attractors and chaos.
I mean, I just learned those terms in the
right,
day, so
right.
I know a lot about
them. I mean, these are terms that come up in system, in
yeah.
talking about systems, and in talking about ordered systems. And I don't know how much justice I can do to them. The chaos theory is systems grew out of some systems theory ideas. And out of that chaos theory has come something called complexity theory, which is sort of a new twist on it all. The attractors sense, that word attractor, is a way of talking about that desire of that system to have that form. So you could say that in that system, the form of the whirlpool is an attractor for the system. It's, if you perturb the system in a way by shaking that bottle a little bit, and you notice when you held it up and nothing happened, it needs a little perturbation to get started. A perturbation is just that shaking, that little nudge, and give it a little start. But once it gets that little start, it takes on this form on its own. And so we call that an attractor, the form that it's drawn to. Chaos is, I don't know if I can come up with a good, simple definition for chaos. Chaotic systems, kind of a baseline, seem to have either no apparent attractors or such a multiplicity of attractors that attractors sort of evenly enough space that the system seems to flip-flop between either different forms of order or between order and what seems to be non-order. And complexity theory says that if you look at chaotic systems enough, if you look long enough and hard enough, you can see a level of order there that may not have been apparent initially. And so maybe ask your question again.
I answered it. I really don't have enough knowledge to ask the question. It's just that it's interesting to me, because I find it fascinating that we can break away a little bit from our mechanistic understanding mm-hmm. of the universe and how it operates. That, to me, that plays a tremendous role in terms of understanding theology in a different way. And so I don't exactly know where you're mm-hmm. going with this.
That's well said. I mean, I think that's, when we started today, I think that was kind of a focus of the, at least what I wanted to say with this, is that with the title, that the mechanistic model of the way the universe works has been very deeply entrenched in the whole scientific enterprise. And the systems theory is breaking somewhat away from that, or moving somewhat out of that perspective, so that these much more organic or, that's another word for them,
Dynamic
systems, I'm sort of lost for words for that. These organic systems are seen as much more indicative of how we exist in the world. I think that many people within the scientific, I don't want to speak for others, but from some of the reading that I've been doing about it, that the systems perspective is gaining a lot of ground over a mechanistic perspective of the way the universe works. The idea that there are these ordered systems.
Were they exclusive of each other?
That's a good question. You have a comment on that, Bruce?
No, I guess I was going to move back to something else. So
okay.
Or is it an interpretation, just how it's interpreted?
Well, I think my understanding of the mechanistic model is a focus on the parts, and that when we're trying to think about something, we break it down into the parts. We look at all of the parts individually, and if we know what all the parts do, then we know what the system does. And a systems perspective says no. You can know what all the parts do and you still won't know what the system does. If you want to know what the system does, you have to look at the system as a whole, as a unit. I think they're not exclusive of each other in that both have uses. To say that a systems approach is better is probably not a good statement or not a true statement. But to say that a mechanistic approach is better is not a good statement. They each sort of inform a different, in a different way, on the nature of things. Yeah.
Are the systems somewhat embodied in the four forces, or is it one system that we're dealing with? When you say systems, mm-hmm. it sort of implies there's a whole bunch of different systems going on.
Right.
How does that
right.
fit with the universe?
Right. Well, it's certainly true that even within a systems perspective, there's a tendency to want to break things into, so I put that water in that bottle, and so now we can think about this sort of system apart from all the other systems that are involved with it. And it may just be the limitation of the way that we can think about things, but there's certainly some movement or at least some philosophical understanding of the universe as a system, that the only model that can do justice to the universe is the universe itself, so that it's a system on its own.
Would that search be somewhat connected with trying to find the unified mm-hmm. theory mm-hmm.
of
the four forces?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It almost seems like it seems like the unified theory, you know, which can to reconcile relativity and quantum mechanics, would be able to explain what exactly is going on in there, in that system, mechanistically.
Hmm.
And so they're not, they wouldn't be separate. They'd be the same things, just looking at it at different levels.
That the mechanistic and the systems perspective would be the same thing. I think that's a valid perspective on it, yeah.
In this case, I would say oftentimes, yes, maybe you can do a mechanistic point of view, but it's a very non-linear, if you're gonna write down some sort of equation which is gonna govern this, it's a very non-linear, fluid, dynamic equation, which could be very difficult to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. A different approach, which looks at the whole system, might be more successful in understanding this particular
problem. Right.
What exactly do you mean by the systems approach? You know, your discussion hasn't really focused on what systems analysis means.
Well, yeah, thank you. That's some clarification on that. It's kind of been a topic that's sort of flowed through some of these sessions. So basically an idea of taking a situation and considering it as a unity rather than breaking it down into its component pieces. And for instance, with this system, the idea would be, instead of thinking about all of the water molecules in there interacting in sort of a complicated fluid dynamics perspective, to try to say something about what's happening with the situation as altogether. What happens as without breaking it into the components and saying what happens, what's happening with those components, what are the forces, the interactions of the component parts, instead of looking at each of those component parts, to try to say look at them as a unity.
So you seek to cast a wider net.
It's sort of a different perspective, maybe, is a way of saying it. You're sort of trying to describe the same thing, but your perspective shift maybe a way of thinking about it is sort of a focusing analogy, that instead of a tight focus, you're sort of taking a wide focus on a situation.
How do you do that when the amount of knowledge that we gain? I mean, perhaps this is an argument for it, but every year or every 20 years, we're doubling the amount of knowledge we have. And taking a systems approach, to me, implies that we know an awful lot about the small pieces in order to look at how they connect together.
Well, it's actually sort of the opposite of that. Yeah, it seems like it's because of this great sense in which we know more and more and more about finer and finer things, that I think that this systems perspective is becoming more valuable, because it's taking a step back from that and saying, I don't really need to, if to understand the situation, I'm not going to focus on the detail of those component pieces. I'm going to try to say something about what's happening here by focusing on it as a whole, as a unity.
Mm-hmm. I'm really over my head.
In
quantum physics, if you use the old Newtonian idea of a mechanistic universe, and you get into the subatomic types of things, and you look at particles and waves, it doesn't work. Am I right? It just doesn't work. You cannot study, because particles all of a sudden become waves, and waves all of a sudden become particles, and you end up really studying, studying the relationship, which is almost the space in between. And that gives you, one of the ways that helps me, and this is kind of maybe slightly, is that enigmatic statement that Jesus reported to have said, I did not come to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. And I think of something, when I try to gain some perspective, because I've been culturally inundated with the whole mechanistic understanding of the universe.
Right.
It just helped a little bit to think that maybe the new sciences are not a way of destroying the mechanistic worldview, but a way of fulfilling them. My suspicion is that, you know, in the generations to come, like you talk about the knowledge we gain, you know, continues to mold. My suspicion is that, you know, in the next generation, there'll be another fulfillment that will go beyond the new sciences.
I think that's, that's well said. We talked about that some yesterday, too, in thinking about, in sort of an analogy or a expression of this in left brain, right brain thinking, where it's not one or the other, but how do you integrate the two into a
study of relations.
Mm-hmm.
What would be an example of equilibrium?
Equilibrium is when you have to go get more coffee because it's just, it's the same temperature as the air around it.
I'm not sure about physics, but the only place I know where equilibrium is defined is in thermodynamics. And there's a nice clear definition. It's a small changes in the system that you can push back into its original configuration without any changes. Isn't that how equilibrium is defined in thermodynamics? That's how I remember it anyways. Change is so small that you can basically reverse the process without any interference from what you're looking at. And it can't be done.
Yeah, in the actual reversing, though, there's something happening, so it doesn't make sense.
Well, it's a construct that's very useful for setting up the law. That's how I remember.
Well, the reversible process is certainly used in thermodynamics.
Yeah.
As kind of a mental construct we're thinking about. But equilibrium, I mean, we can look at equilibrium in this system when just right now there's equilibrium in that system.
That's an unstable equilibrium.
Yes, shake. It's an unstable equilibrium. Now shake that system and you'll get this dissipative event happening. And when all the water is in the bottom, then you have a stable equilibrium for that system.
No, I think the systems approach is wonderful, and in fact, there's many examples of system ties with people who look at the broad picture, people to know relationships. I guess you could say many people, many physicists have looked at the big picture and tied things together. I mean, if you tie the drop of an apple to the motion of the planets, and brought two sciences together, two realms of endeavor, the people of man. Who's the electrician?
Maxwell.
Maxwell.
Yeah, James Clerk Maxwell. Right. Well, I think it's a different thing to say a synthesizing or a bringing together would be a different thing than because from Newton's perspective, certainly it was a carefully analytic perspective that we break down this system of the Earth and Sun into the mass of the Earth, the mass of the Sun, and the gravitational interaction between those two. And so if we know something about the individual components and this thing called gravity, then we can say what's going to happen. And I mean, it's a powerful tool. It's a powerful way of thinking about things.
So you're suggesting that perhaps they did not use the system.
Right. That a systems approach to that same would be to say, consider the system of Earth and Sun together. And consider the motion of that system. Look at what look at that as a dissipative system and see what the attractors are there. See if you can define that system in terms of its attractors, its stable and unstable equilibrium.
One of the definitions in physics of a system is usually, or they usually try and think of things as closed systems, but it doesn't really exist in reality.
Right, right.
So it's always going to be limited in that sense. Mm-hmm. But you know, you say think of the system of the Earth and the Sun, mm-hmm. but then there's also the rest of the solar system.
Right.
And so however far out you go, there's still more. So it's always going to be limited in that sense.
And dissipative systems tend to be open systems. I mean, that tends to be the situation there. You have this energy flow, energy coming in, energy going out. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a quick definition of entrapment?
The one that we gave was the form of that whirlpool. The
so a form is an entrapment.
Maybe a stable dynamic state. I don't know if that helps. The fact that water wants to spin or has this tendency for moving in that certain way, that certain motion would be an attractor in that system.
Would the whole universe be considered a dissipatory system as with the Big Bang being the original?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if that would be. I mean, certainly there's a sense in which the sort of the most interesting perspective I see.
The dissipatory system is defined by some other energy source inside of it.
Right.
Although it incorporates the universe. Mm-hmm. Your energy sources are within the universe.
Though the energy source in the universe is really the hydrogen atoms. The fact that in the expansion of the universe was at such a rate that hydrogen did not have. Was not sort of in that temperature and heat transformed into helium, carbon, all into iron, basically, in sort of an end process.
Right.
Yeah. So you would need to sort of reformulate that. But it's certainly true that the universe is using a higher energy, the hydrogen that's being transformed within the suns, changing that into a lower energy and creating order out of that. So we might have to reformulate that a little bit to get to think of the universe as a dissipative system. But I think you could do that. I'd like to finish up here, since we only have a few minutes before Vespers, with a poem that I found up on a bulletin board that I think ties some of this together, the sense of water and systems. I'll just read this and then we'll talk about it a little bit. It's entitled Holden. There is an alpine river there that tumbles gleefully among the rocks through the spruce and fir forests. There is a village of pilgrims there with a spiritual stream that bubbles and flows among and with the people. After a while, it became harder to tell the difference. Either way, I know that if I ever get lost, I'll just listen for the river. That's by Jeanne Marcy. And that idea that, what struck me about that poem was her sense that after a while it became harder to tell the difference between the stream and the community that formed up. That in some way the system of the river with its changing the higher energy from the gravitational potential from the water of these glaciers down to the water in the lake, and in that process creating these wonderfully dynamic systems throughout this valley. Whirlpools and cascades and these carvings within the rocks. And that somehow this community of Holden is also, you know, creating this order in this valley, this great, beautiful thing. And that after a while, it becomes harder to tell the difference between those two things. So just to finish, I have a little bit of water here. And I'd like to do a little meditation with this water. The meditation is really on a system that we are a part of, the system of the earth, the system that is sometimes easy for me to put myself outside of in conceptualization and in abstraction and thinking about things. And it's always helpful for me sometimes to reflect on the truth that this water, as I drink it, becomes me. I mean, this water becomes not just a part of my body, but it flows within my bloodstream, into my brain. It's the stuff that supports these neuron firings that somehow have these conceptualizations that we don't really understand how that works. That fundamentally, in drinking this water, I'm taking part in this system of the earth. I'm taking in this energy and creating order in some mysterious way. That as you drink this water, as you take a drink of this water, hold that image in mind. And so if you go ahead, I'll sort of take that drink. And imagine this water entering into your bloodstream, through your stomach, the lining of your stomach, moving into your bloodstream now, becoming part of your bloodstream, pumped by your heart through your arteries and veins, up through your arteries, through your neck, into your head, and now reflecting, being a part of that system that's reflecting on the water that you just drank, that's seeing it, that understands that water is a part of itself.